going to come on, so watch what you say.
Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order for March 12th and open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3. Senator Haas, thank you for being with us. Please help us get oriented while you're getting settled. Barbara, if you wouldn't mind giving us a quick summary.
Certainly. HCR 3 expresses appreciation for James Bosley's service in the Oregon television industry and his legacy of commitment and devotion to his community on behalf of the state of Oregon.
Senator Haas.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I appreciate you hearing this. Jim Bosley was a very, very well-known weatherman from the 60s through 2001. And just being well-known, however, is probably not up to the standard to be memorialized by the Oregon legislature. And we probably wouldn't be talking about him if he were only well-known or popular. But I worked with him for many years at the same place at KATU, and what I saw was someone who used his popularity and felt an obligation to use the fact that he was well-known to do good things. And he was very involved with charities, as many of you are and have been involved in auctions and emceeing and that sort of thing. This was his weekend, every weekend for 30 years. It was with the Royal Rosarians, it was with a church, it was with a school. He was in parades. He was in more parades than anybody I've ever known. And that's the reason that that we're memorializing him, is not because he was a well-known weather guy, but because he was a good Oregonian. We have a DVD. It's 4 or 5 minutes long. I think we'll show that. I'll be done.
And we'll pass it, I hope. Thank you.
Funniest things I know come from viewers who rip me. Dear Jim, every time you come on the TV, the dog starts to bark and whine. And we thought it was so cute. We had the neighbors come over, and now we don't think it's cute anymore. We start watching Channel 6.
Blue sky smiling at me. Nothing but blue skies.
Along the Northwest TV landscape, there are few names that are more recognizable than The Boz, a man who created a television legacy spanning four decades, a man who did it all just by being himself.
Since I had been 4 years old, I've wanted to toot the horn on a train. See that? That just sends chills up and down my spine.
There was never a situation where I ever saw him on the air where he was either ill at ease and didn't have, you know, that total capacity to relate to the audience.
You believe that?
No.
When he came into the studio, it seemed like it warmed up and he brought light with him.
He always made me laugh. He was so funny and so spontaneous.
Jim Bosley was born in Great Falls, Montana. After high school, he entered the University of Washington's pre-med program, but ended up taking a little detour.
I thought I'd take a year off and never went back to med school, and television seemed like a likely place to go.
He spent 4 years at KOTI-TV in Klamath Falls, Oregon.
Stand by for K2!
KTU opened up in Portland in March of 62, and I wanted to be the creative director. So I sent a resume up, and out of 360 applicants, I won. And then in 1967, the weatherman on Channel 2, a neat guy named Kirby Brumfield, went on vacation, and the program director said, "I know you did weather down in Klamath Falls. Can you sound like you know what you're doing?" So I said, "Oh, yeah."
The audience reaction was so great, the Boz jumped from the world of promotion to the world of cold fronts and forecasts.
The Big News on 2, in color at 5, with Portland's most knowledgeable news team, led by Ted Knight, anchorman, Art Ekman on sports, and Jim Bosley with weather.
He talked about the weather the way you wanted to know about the weather.
He was very sensitive to how people feel weather and how they receive his broadcast at home.
I looked at the weather as something that was serious when it was serious. I gave everybody my best. I'd lay awake nights worried about stuff. All meteorologists do that. They got the best equipment in the world, and they still give you that slight chance of sprinkles just so they're not wrong. I invented that.
In 1975, programming director Chuck Gingold tapped Jim to host another on-air production.
It's time now for AM Northwest with your host, Jim Bosley.
Unique, so different than anyone else. What we refer to as a truly big personality.
It was a pleasure meeting you, my friend.
I don't shake hands.
That's all, folks.
Pamela, I said, now there's a guy who can do a talk show.
I think he just loved sitting down and talking to people. And he has a great curiosity.
We have had a lot of authors over the years. Jim always read the books. His house, he's got this huge, huge library of books that he has saved over the years. I think he's got his what he calls his Watergate wall.
It says Julie Nixon Eisenhower. Is that the way you sign your checks?
Yes, it is. Isn't that terrible?
Really? Yes. Is that what's on your credit card? I get up in the morning and you go on the set on AM Northwest and, you know, we'd have an audience. And there'd be 20 people, 50, 150, 200 people. And you get a standing ovation. Well, how is that at 9 o'clock in the morning to start your day?
In 2000, after 33 years of service to K2 viewers and the community, the Boz retires.
Thank you. You people out there, all of you, have been the words and the music to my song, and I thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, with Jim, what you see is what you get. His personality on the air is his personality off the air.
He's funny, he's sincere, he's irreverent.
Jim is, above all, a gentleman.
He has a magnetic force with people that is just tremendous.
Bosley, really, when you're talking television, he's done it all.
Jim is legendary. There's no question about it.
It's a very heavy word, legend. But I think if anyone, if it applies to anyone, it would be Jim Bosley.
If viewers are lucky, there'll be somebody that'll come along that will have some of the personality and characteristics of a Jim Bosley. But there won't ever be an exact copy.
Everybody felt like they knew him, and everybody liked him.
I think that, you know, people, you know, think of television, they'll think of Jim Bosley.
Very nice.
I would just close to say if there was ever somebody who embodied the Oregon spirit, it was him. So that's the reason I'm here. I know you have other pressing state business, and I could go on and on and on and take questions, but I very much appreciate your consideration of this. I know his family does, too.
Thank you, Senator Hess. Any questions? I wonder if you would just share some particular story that you had during your days working together.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that he did that was very creative and simple, but he used to rate the days, like today's 7 and I think tomorrow we'll have 8. That was a very effective broadcasting technique because it was just so simple, people related to it. And he started doing that about, I don't know, in the 80s somewhere. It was picked up and copied in television markets all over the country. It was just, you know, simple elegance. And the one thing that you saw with him, if you started with him back in the 60s, in the 60s, the weather guy was sort of where the class clown eventually ends up. And what you had to know how to do then was how to take a magnet of the sun and one of clouds and put them on, you know, your map and kind of joke around. Well, today, if you think of your meteorologists, they're pretty professional, and they're not so much yuck it up kind of guys. They've got the latest sophisticated software and computer modeling. And Jim adapted to that evolution. He went back to school and studied and got his meteorology certification. And he became a meteorologist, I think begrudgingly and reluctantly figured out the computer systems. And he personally sort of lived through that evolution to the modern day meteorologist we see today versus the kind of joker guy we used to see, you know, 3 or 4 decades ago.
I just have one question. You talked about the rating system that he gave. Did he pioneer
weather cats. He had Bob the Weather Cat, didn't he?
We had Bob the Weather Cat.
Yes.
I don't think he would claim authorship of that, but I've never seen it copied anywhere else.
I haven't seen it since either. I just was curious.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Holy?
I just wanted to comment in reading this that, you know, I'm impressed also that he used his notoriety to do a lot of charitable work, and noting the Dornbecker's Children's Hospital is one that I'm familiar with, and, you know, just that he went door-to-door and did food bank things and stuff. I just think that's really a mark of a real community leader. So.
Sure. Appreciate that. Thank you. If there aren't any other comments, close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 and open a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Holby has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Be adopted,
I think, is that correct? Okay. Very good. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none. Motion is adopted, and Representative Gilliam, would you be so kind as to carry the resolution?
I'd be honored. Mr. Chair, when we do a resolution like this, do we do it on the same day in both chambers?
We've already done it.
The Senate has already adopted it.
Did the family, may I ask our...
Please.
Did the family come that day?
Mr. Chair, committee, the family did.
Okay.
No, I don't know if we want to totally replicate that.
Yeah.
Just get Karen down or neither, but how about I work with
we'll
you,
to you yeah.
arrange, make some arrangements.
And how about Rebecca Webb? Would she be somebody we'd want to invite to the...
Of course.
Because I think when he went off the air, I think she was his co-host. Anyway.
Yeah, we can talk some more about it.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2715. Representative Broom, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And perhaps as you get we could have a summary of House Bill 2715.
HB 2715 permits certain corporations to defer state income or excise taxes otherwise due and defines three criteria which must be met for eligibility: maximum annual revenue, minimum number of employees, and maximum number of years in existence. Describes the oversight role of the Department of Revenue, including developing an application process, determining eligibility, and applying one of two specific calculation options to the deferral. Permits the department to lien the property in the amount of the deferral, and defines the calculation of interest accrual on the deferred taxes. Limits the deferral for a maximum of 2 years and delineates repayment options. Becomes effective on tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2010.
Thank you. Representative Broom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I bring to you today House Bill 2715, which is co-sponsored by Representative David Edwards. I talked to Representative Edwards before this, and he has testimony on another bill in a different committee, so we split the assignment on this one, but he wanted me to, of course, extend his support of the bill and hopefully that it would get a favorable hearing. This idea is something that I've been noodling with, for lack of a technical description, for the last 4 years, and it's based on an idea that I actually, of all places, heard from Senator John Kerry years ago on legislation that was talked about at the federal level. To sort of summarize it in a simple way, what it would do is let a very small, very young business capitalize itself with some of its own retained earnings, some of those earnings which would be obligated to the state in income taxation for 2 years, and then up to 2 years, and then pay back that interest, or pay back that tax debt, if you will, with interest over the next four. The idea being, of course, that it would allow a company to reinvest itself, to perhaps hire the employees, perhaps buy the equipment, perhaps buy the marketing, or whatever that given small business needed to help expand its business. By definition, at least by one definition, it has to be a successful business for this to work, and that's one of the, you know, when this comes up in conversations, one of the pushbacks, if you will, or not pushbacks, but one of the issues that comes up is, well, you know, what happens if they go out of business or those sorts of questions. Those are good questions, and you can't solve all that with this bill. But what you can do, the way this bill is written, is be confident that at least by one measure of success, the company is already successful, and that is having a net income that's taxable. So let me give you a little bit of background. Excuse me. I spent 10 years in commercial banking, and the old axiom is absolutely true. Those that need the money the most, it's always the hardest for them to borrow money. Commercial banking is very good at providing loan and credit tools, products, if you will, for well-established businesses that have a good track record. And a good track record could be anywhere from 5 to 50 years, have financial statements that can go back at least 3 or 4 years. Banks are not usually one, nor should they be, and we've learned this lesson clearly, should be one that get into startups or young businesses that frankly don't have a great track record, even if they're a successful business and that they're making money. That's just not the way that banks operate. So forever, the most dominant means of capitalization for a small business, and when I'm talking small business, I mean think of a small grocery store, think of a bookstore that sells coffee, think of somebody who's got something in his garage, he's manufacturing a die cast or something. I mean, the possibilities are endless. The way that those sort of entities have financed themselves, credit financed themselves, is usually through a credit card. Paying anywhere from 12 to 20% interest, and obviously a high, I guess it measures the risk, but paying a high rate of interest on their borrowings. What this idea would do is give these small companies that qualify the opportunity to basically borrow money from the state, their tax obligation to the state, at a better interest rate, a comparable bank interest rate, than compared to the rates that they pay on a credit card. There's a mistake in this bill, and I'll point it out right away, and Jody Weiser brought to my attention, and we will be working on an amendment to fix it. But it talks about the primary discount rate as the rate of interest that would be charged to these small companies. That's the wrong rate. That's, in a sense, the rate that banks borrow money from each other. It's a very low rate, and that's not what we're talking here. The idea was to be the prime rate, and it got lost in the translation with LC. So we will have an amendment made that firmly establishes that what we're talking about here is the prime rate of interest that's published every day in the newspaper, that is the prime rate of that does float based on what the prime set or what the bank set, but it's always the same. The banks always have the same prime rate of interest. Usually, always have the same prime rate of interest. Another thing that we will be adding with that amendment is a 8-year sunset clause on this. Now, as you if when you read the bill, you'll see that basically it takes 6 years for the project, if you will, to come to full fruition. They get to a company would have the option to defer their taxes for 2 years, and then have the option. They could pay it back all at once, but have the option to pay it back in quarterly installments over 4 years. So start to finish, you're talking basically 6 years. So 8 years, I think, would be a good test. And I fully admit that this is meant to be almost an experiment. Because of that, because I don't know the effect. I'm optimistic about the effect it'll have, and I know what I want it to achieve, but it's never been done. And so I think that it's prudent to sort of keep it small as an experiment. And that's why it's designed as it is. It's designed only for C corporations. That's the last way a small company is incorporated. Most companies nowadays, young companies, are incorporated as partnerships, LLCs, or S corps. C corps is the smallest lot of that. And then, of course, the other sideboards, if you will, it has to have at least 2 employees, has to have no more than $3.5 million in sales. So that was a lot of words, Mr. Chair. I just throw it back if you have any questions. And once again, I appreciate you hearing this bill today.
Pleasure. Thank you for bringing the idea. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bruin, thanks for bringing this forward. It may surprise my colleague to the right that I'm looking at this with an open mind. And, after first glance, I thought this is crazy. But in just sort of looking at it, I'm a little bit intrigued by it. I'm curious, do we have any information on the success of startup C corps that fit this description in terms of, their success or whether they dissolve with no assets after a certain amount of time?
It's a great question and unanswerable, although I've tried to find the answers to it. Part of what this is, you can't get exact. I mean, the first question that comes to mind naturally is, well, how many companies are we talking about? What sort of dollars would we be potentially laying out there for deferment? We don't have an answer to that. the problem, you know, one of the questions that comes up is how many companies, given this option, would decide to actually register as a C corporation versus an S corp or an LLC. How many companies, given this option, that may decide to switch from an S corp to a C corp? Don't know the answer to those questions, and we also don't know the answer to Department of Revenue. And this has a subsequent referral. Department of Revenue can tell us how many companies are C corps, and certainly you can look at an incorporation date and say, hey, if they're incorporated in 2008, then the window for this would be till, of course, 2013. But we don't have those answers yet. And so once again, I lay this out here as it's almost more conceptual than it is. Hey, it's going to affect 25 companies, and it's this much money. What I feel fairly confident in saying is that by design, it's going to have a pretty small a net group of companies that could potentially benefit from it, and that is by design. Because once again, I'm sold on the theory, if you will, but fully admit it is just that, it is a theory. Hence the need for a small experiment, if you will. I don't think it's a pilot project, because it would sort of be open to all comers rather than a select few. But it's a small experiment designed to be a small experiment to keep the size small. And if it fails miserably, you don't want that to negatively affect the state, and you'll have a sunset to stop it. But if it works, that, which I would hope, that would be the idea. You'd go from there and expand it, hopefully, to a larger potential market. Mm-hmm. That's a very long-winded answer to your question, how many companies would it affect? Not many is sort of the answer.
Follow up? Thank you. I was just trying to get a banker's investment strategy on this and how they would guarantee their return. But beyond that question, I was curious about, would there be some way to look at this to, I guess, prevent the gaming of the system where if a corporation decided to dissolve or with no assets or declared bankruptcy, right? Obviously that would be the risk that we would lose in, but would there be a way to look at corporations that would dissolve that had assets to make sure that it got paid back?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Polk, thank you for the question. By design, a C corporation, if they dissolve, the owners, if you will, or the principals don't carry the obligation. Now, a C corporation could be in a situation where the owners of the company would guarantee debt. Mm-hmm. And that may be something that we look at. I'm not opposed to that idea. I mean, I don't mean this to be by any stretch of imagination, to be a tool where people are gaming the system. And if that particular answer is the way to solve a potential problem like that, I would support that. Beyond that, though, I don't think you can attach the assets. You can attach as long as the person would do that, and that could be the requirement. That's a banking requirement. A bank has a line of credit to a C corporation, but and wants to securitize it. For whatever reasons, the company is not willing to securitize their assets, and there's reasons for that, that a bank may be inclined to ask for a personal guarantee. That is where I think you would find this being, because if the company dissolves, those assets go away anyway. It's probably an easier job for the Department of Revenue. There's a tax lien to begin with, but probably a easier job for the Department of Revenue to follow an individual guarantee rather than a securitization of assets.
Thank you for that answer.
Other questions so far? I had a couple just in general. How did you pick $3.5 million as the threshold?
Just like the 10,000 missile gap, when they came, it's arbitrary.
Okay.
It was just had to find a number that, once again, kept the sample size. I mean, large enough to matter,
right?
But small enough to keep the sample size low, but no other science other than that, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Have you thought about a cap amongst the amendments to say there wouldn't be any more than this number of applicants, or if there was a way to capture
truly turn it into a pilot project?
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. I'm not opposed to that whatsoever. Yeah. I mean, if that's, I'm interested to see this bill move because I'm interested to test the experiment.
Right.
And if that's the committee's prerogative to make it move, I'm all for that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Benz, did you have a
question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the idea that the amount would be annual? Is the, in other words, $200,000 of tax deferred this year, then another $200,000 next?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it's spelled out clearly in the bill. My idea was annual, because everything's written, even though it's it's over 2 years and over 4 years. The three and a half million, as an example, is meant to be an annual. So yes, it was meant within a given year. The lower of $200,000 in net income, which is going to be hard to achieve for a small business. I mean, that's a fairly successful small business hitting $2.5 million, especially if they're under $3.5 million in revenue, or 80%, the lesser of those two.
Hold on, Mr. Chair, please.
So once again, it's designed not to have every dollar of tax obligation go into this deferral. There would still be a portion of the net income that would be taxable. And of course, the point I want to reiterate is the goal here is to make a healthier, stronger, growing company at the time when they need that cash flow the most. Without getting into a dissertation on the need and the timing of cash flow. When a company is not growing, their cash flow needs are not as prevalent. When a company is growing, whether they're profitable or not, that's the time for cash and cash flow, and that's the reason. That's primarily what we're trying to capture in this particular idea.
It just seemed to me that if you came to March 15th, I think is when the C corps are supposed to file, and you didn't have the money. Or you had it because you've used it for capital purposes. You've used that which you should be paying to the state. So you run down on March 1st to get a loan. You would then compare the amount of the cost of these funds, which is prime, against the amount of cost of that which you would borrow, which would be something higher.
Higher now.
So the value at $200,000 per point would be about $2,000 per point of interest increase. Sure. So you could borrow it at 4% today, whatever prime is. But to get to any place else, it would cost you 8.
Sure.
So the space. So you'd be measuring that savings, and asking yourself if that lien that the state would then take on everything you've got was worth the savings, which would be $1,000
right.
$2,000
right.
per point.
Sure.
So to me, the question is what. Whether this will ever be used, because I've dealt with so many businesses that have had these liens, these blanket liens, and they're, you better not be borrowing it from anybody else because they're really quite negative.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But I was just curious if you worry that this won't be used because of that blanket lien.
Well, it's once again a good question, and I don't know the answer to that question. This is once again designed. I mean, I don't know how many bills you'll hear this year where the bill proponent gets in front of you and goes, it's an experiment. But it truly is an experiment. It's designed with the understanding that in the best of times, it's difficult for a small growing business to get traditional financing, and it is virtually, if not entirely, impossible for a small startup company or newer company to find traditional bank financing in this current credit crunch environment. So to answer your question, if it is a capital-intensive business, that is a debt-intensive business, that needs to factor receivables or any other, dozens of reasons why it doesn't make sense, then it wouldn't make sense. I'm not sure, though, we're not in that perfect world anymore, nor necessarily are we talking about just capital-intensive, potentially debt-intensive, asset-secured sort of businesses. As I mentioned at the start of this, that's great if that's one of the options. It's also we're talking about, as I mentioned in a conversation I had earlier today, it might be the husband and wife who decide to open the used bookstore / coffee shop. Obviously a small business endeavor, but part of filling the bookshelves and buying the coffee requires cash. Especially with an import situation, the cash flow from their sales doesn't quite capitalize their need to buy longer-term inventory, and so this would help them to bridge that gap rather than just using their personal credit card.
And that does bring me to that issue of security, because I didn't see that in here as a requirement. It was merely that there would be a lien on whatever the business had.
Right.
So to the extent, if there's nothing there, but they
nothing
didn't,
there, then it's just have a tax lien, then there's nothing there.
They're not there.
Yeah.
So,
but I would only reiterate that, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that a company, by definition, and I'm conscious to the gaming the system and certainly want to not have that happen and rein that in, but a company, to even get to the point where they qualify to do this, has to have a track record of success. Okay. Most of the time in a situation where you would be gaming the system or ripe for failure, you wouldn't qualify to begin with under this bill. Can you find can you come up with a hypothetical that would be an exception to that? Of course. But I think that would be a rare thing.
It may be that I just missed it when you said it, but could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by a record of success? Is there value in having, you have the ceiling of $3.5 million. Yeah. Is it worth having a floor?
Sales is not a record. Sales is a measure of sales. It's right. Not necessarily a record of success. Right. And if I were selling cars and selling them at $2,000, I guarantee I'd knock sales out of the park. I'd be the world leader in car sales. Of course, I'd be bankrupt in a week, if not sooner. So once again, the revenue side, the sales side, is not the measure of success. The measure of success is profit, is taxable profit. And a company to qualify for this program has to be profitable. Now, it can be profitable one year and not profitable the next, of course. But at least by the starting standard of this bill, you don't qualify unless you've got a tax liability.
Thanks for reminding me. So the only other two questions that occur to me, have you had any conversations with small business generally that suggest they'd be interested in this? And do you have any knowledge of other states that may have tried anything similar?
No other knowledge to the latter part, no other knowledge of states that have tried something similar. I've had over 4 years, frankly, is how long I've been looking at this, and had numerous conversations anecdotally with small business, whether it's town halls, whether it's at coffee shops, whether it's just buddies or neighbors that have small business. I say, well, hey, what do you think about this? And I'm like, yeah, I can see that. I mean, it certainly wasn't a chalkboard. Well, if you do this and the yield is... they're not those sorts of conversations.
Bring Representative Bailey along.
Right, exactly. We haven't had the Eco Northwest conversation yet. But from just a purely anecdotal, does it sound like it's a good idea? Yeah, I've had dozens of those, more than those conversations. Let me just reiterate, I have no idea how many companies would utilize this. There's really no way to tell. The biggest positive, I think, with this bill is we are in abnormal times. Okay, does it make sense to do something that, in the normal time, this is sort of quirky. I don't know. I mean, we don't know. I mean, it is. I admit that this is a little bit quirky, a little bit out of the norm. But if there are times to merit that, I think there are these times. Once again, you have to be cautious. I mean, our job as legislators is not to just, throw all caution to the wind by any stretch of the imagination. That's why the bill is written. And we'll actually, with the amendment, even tighten that up a little bit with the sunset clause, which is not in there now, to limit in this experiment and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, I'll own up to it and say it didn't work. But if it does work, I think it's a path.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a question that will come up at revenue. So,
yeah.
Did you compare this structure to someone who just doesn't pay their taxes? Because then the state of Oregon will file a lien, and there will be an interest rate, and many of the same things that happen here happen under that scenario. But of course, there's penalties and other issues. But there's already a structure in place. If you don't have the money to pay the tax, there will be a lien filed, and then there will be collection activities.
Right.
But I'm just wondering if that, I guess that's for, that goes to this uncertain economic time that we're within, because we may be looking at that a lot soon. But did you compare those two, this against that?
Mr. Chair, no, we didn't. Your point is well taken, and there is, I guess, that would be a positive for the bill. There's sort of a mechanism to do this. Obviously, the differences would be, do you want the state of Oregon to call you, or are you working with the state of Oregon?
Right.
So, this would be a positive, not an antagonistic, relationship.
And in fact, just to amplify that, I've been having some discussions with the department about another bill, and we haven't gotten into the details around payment plans, but it would be worthwhile to compare what they typically do in those situations where they work out payment plans with a taxpayer who can't pay what they owe immediately, and how that might compare to this. Any questions down here? Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I can articulate my question, but I'm...
Watch out.
I'm really not sure what it is. But I'd be scared it wouldn't come out what I wanted, I'm sure. But in any respect, you know, I'm just thinking about this in the terms of what this bill really is, and I'm still intrigued by it, so don't take offense to my question. But in the world of private sector banking, you know, because this kind of puts the state in the role of essentially loaning money and on a potential future income, I suppose, that is a little bit risky, perhaps, because it doesn't. Well, it has some qualifications, but I'm just curious from a banker's historical perspective. I mean, if this was your private pot of money, would you consider a program like this as a private banker? At a smaller scale, obviously.
Yeah.
Or if your bank was as big as Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Holby, absolutely. If that helps me back.
if I understand
a little hesitation there, I know.
Let me answer this by saying that.
Well, maybe you should sign up for some stimulus money.
No longer in commercial banking was because of my constant frustration with what I thought were overly tight credit standards. Okay, so my job was production oriented, my job was to find businesses, understand the business, financially analyze the business, and then see what sort of credit products that business could justify, both in cash flow strength, profitability, asset strength, the competition of the business. I mean, you name all the factors you've all heard about.
Are you still feeling that way about tight credit standards these days?
Well, it's a different deal. The problems we're having now are not based on too tight or too loose of credit standards on a commercial operating entity that's making, say, tractor parts. The problems we're having now, not to oversimplify it, are based on credit and securitization instruments that this banker doesn't even come close to understanding, and that I'm not even sure the Wall Street people who are selling them and propagating them understand completely either. So, I mean, it's a different. I mean, I understand the question. It's a little bit different animal. My point, I guess, to answer your question is, in my banking days, not that we're talking about my banking days, but my clearly understanding the risks, my position was always to, given the caution, to err on the side of saying yes than to err on the side of saying no. If the risk didn't merit that, then I would support that. But that was my job, was to sell. Okay, credit underwriters' job are to make sure that are perfectly protected. And anytime there is a question mark, to err on the side of caution rather than the risk side. And so you found yourself as a banker in a situation where you had all sorts of responsibility, but zero authority. And so that was, you know, why I it was a great first career, but not where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. And so that was a long-winded way to answer your question. That yes, I, as a banker, in the role that I had in banking, I would look at it and know that you're going to have failures. You're going to have, you know, if you're in a bank that has no credit failures, you're a horrible bank because you've left a whole bunch of opportunities on the table. There's certain failure ratios that a bank wants to have because it means their credit underwriting is not so harsh and so tight that they're leaving good business on the table.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that answer. And you know, with every investment, there's a risk, and so, you know, that's something we do recognize. But I guess more to my point, perhaps, is that, you know, for a bill like this, I would want to make sure that the state, you know, provided the scrutiny over those potential risks and had, you know, some standards as you described, mm-hmm. as to looking at the risk of the investment, maybe a little bit more than what's in this particular bill. I don't know if that waters down the bill to a large degree, but it's just a concern, I think, that I'm thinking about.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Rep. Holby, I mean, I think it's a good point. To reiterate, that's why it's sort of a small sample size. If you get much past that, as Jody might tell you, there's options that not only the state but the federal government offers for small businesses. They still have underwriting. They still work in conjunction with private
banks. Mm-hmm. There's balance sheet analysis. There's income statement analysis. There's cash flow analysis. There's having the 3 years of financial statements. All of those, even with SBA sorts of loans, you still have all those same underwriting requirements. The difference is that a bank is going to probably more quickly get into a small business loan situation, knowing that they're a little bit protected by the guarantee of the governing entity, whether it's the state or the federal government. That's already there, and that's established. This once again is a different way to look at it. It's not loaning new money. It's not loaning capital outside of the business. It's loaning the company's own own earnings and letting them be retained rather than having them sent out immediately in taxes. Those earnings will be paid in taxes eventually, but for the short term, retaining those earnings while a company is this very high growth stage, a young company, to be able to self-capitalize and do all the things that we talked about.
Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You offered the opportunity for me to speak for him. He didn't, but I would say that I think what my friend meant to say was, I'm for this unless I'm against it.
Sorry. maybe in the reverse order.
For it, so I
Representative Vance,
clear.
When you referred to revenue, were you referring to this going to revenue or to the department?
Probably both. Subsequent referral.
There is a subsequent referral.
Yes.
If I'd read that, I probably would have known that. Well, I would just say this. We haven't talked about this. I commend you for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
I appreciate the being, our responsible questions and our wanting to put sideboards on it, but at this stage in this state's economy and future, I don't know what we have to lose, really. And I think, as I read it, not at all being close to understanding this economy, we need cash in play. And it couldn't be more true than at the local or small business level. And I think if we are going to get out of this, we're going to need every small business we can encourage and sustain. And it sounds like a very worthwhile experiment or program. So other than the fact that the chair's name's on it, I am all for it.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up with Representative Gilliam and what he might have meant to say.
In that in committee we can attribute things to other members rather than what we're not supposed to do on the floor, right?
As long as you allow it.
so long as it's good natured, it's okay.
I almost lost the train of thought now, but in speaking about, I don't know what we have to lose. I think there still is a risk, and potentially we could lose revenue, and potentially that could result in shorter school years or something else, depending on the magnitude of the loss. So, I think that's what my colleague meant to say.
And prior to your seeking recognition, I was going to look down this way and see if there's any questions, and seeing that there aren't, I'm going to say that Representative Gilliam actually perhaps gave us a nice segue in that we can invite the only other person who has signed up to testify on this bill, Jody Weiser, up, and perhaps she can enlighten us. I don't mean to foreshadow any of her testimony, but Jody, if you'd like to come forward, I imagine you might have something to say about that too. If you have the time, I think that'd be great.
Sure. While she's coming up, I would say, no, that's what he thinks.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, were you looking down to this end of the dais to see if this end wanted to have any witty banter as well?
It's always welcome.
Okay.
We're out of control down here.
Oh, Lordy.
We're having a good time, though.
You are. Jody Weiser with Task Force Oregon. So I'm from Washington County, where there are a whole lot of people who are probably going to be trying to start businesses in the next few years because they're getting laid off from jobs and they've had some money. But when I read this bill last night, it made me concerned. And it made me concerned for a number of reasons. It seems to make the Department of Revenue into the Department of Economic Development. And that's not a role they have any expertise in. And it leaves to the way it's currently written, it leaves to the person who decides they want a loan. They certify whether they are eligible for this loan or not. And there's nothing that keeps them from certifying when they know that they're going broke. And that doesn't seem to be a prudent use of our funds. The OECD does have loans. They do not generally loan, for instance, to restaurants. I do know of one restaurant that they loaned to, and it was the first ever, but it was the Crooked River Train. It was really quite a lot more than a restaurant. And so under this program, restaurants, which is probably the business most likely to fail, even after years of success, you think of Ron Paul's in Portland as a good example, it's that we're putting ourselves into a pretty risky place by not asking this responsibility to be placed with a department whose job it is to look at what we're doing. And perhaps what we need to do is just give them more money to loan out. There is a really tight market for money, and there are going to be needs for money. But it seems to me, rather than the Department of Revenue, this is a place that we would place responsibility for this, and that there would need to be some parameters like the ones you've all been discussing. I don't think, other than that comment, there's really much that you haven't covered on your own that I had notes on. But I did congratulate myself of having thought of most of the things you thought of. That I would think you also would want some kind of cap. Could be a cap in the dollars that you would allow annually, or in the number of programs that, you know, different businesses that might use it. But I think that we need to know what kind of potential risk we're putting the state in if we say, okay, here's a new program, we're going to try it for 8 years. I agree that you need a period of time to find out if it's going to work. And I think that very few companies would borrow $200,000, because 6.6% of $3.5 million gross, it means that they have about $31,000 worth of overhead and expenses, which is a very unusual company. You could probably lower that $200,000 and reduce it a lot. But still, the way the bill reads, we're saying to somebody, do you want a $400,000 credit card? And we don't have any requirements for that, except that you are owing that many dollars in taxes. And that doesn't seem to be the way we should be doing business in the state. We don't do that for our departments. We can't do it for our potential taxpayers either.
Thank you, Jody. Are there questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will you forgive me and identify yourself again? I didn't hear.
My name is Jody Weiser. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. And I don't think I've been in a committee with you before,
okay.
Ms.
We know her very well, Representative Gillian, because she's a regular presence in the Revenue Committee.
Okay,
so
right.
I expected her reputation.
Her, and that may be for obvious reasons.
Well, I think I might have seen the reasons. I'm with an all-volunteer citizens group, and my background is I did have business experience because my family was a family farm, and I was involved until a few years ago in that business. But I've also been a school teacher and started nonprofits and all sorts of other things.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Because I appreciate you coming, and I appreciate the caution. I mentioned that earlier. But I have to say, I'm still unconvinced, partly because I just believe, if you want to talk about at risk, I believe we are at risk. And I'm having a surreal experience, you know, of serving in a legislature at a time when we spent 2 hours in another committee the other day just listing the billions of dollars that are going to come pouring out and drown us in another way, not in great wealth, but it's going to drown us in ability to use it. And facing with all my colleagues up here and everybody in the building how we're going to fill $4 billion and falling. Mm-hmm. So, caution is great. But when we've got somebody from the business community, and I appreciate the fact of your background, because I don't come from the business community. And I was thinking about this the other day. The folks in the business community are the ones that have taken risks, in my opinion, and have made this state go forward. And we may be stuck right now, and you can blame it wherever you want to
place the blame, but going forward, we're going to need business. And I think this is, if not just a symbol, this is a very practical way to help people who are willing to take risk and take some risk. Now, from a policy standpoint, I am unconcerned about asking revenue to help small business, even though it may, as you point out, be something we don't normally do for other departments. But I certainly wouldn't be wanting to retract and say, well, let's just find more money, which we don't have, and put it over at economic development, which does do ordinarily do loans and startups and all that. I just wouldn't be willing to do that. The money's in play. I'll stop at that. I'm still very supportive,
maybe
but I appreciate
your... Maybe I can add a question to that, that could sort of inform a response. Has there been any thought on part of either of you about whether there could be a way to bring the OECDD, as it's currently called, and we may be changing that name, into this discussion? It strikes me that the Department of Revenue knows how the mechanics of the taxes operate, but that OECDD might be in a better position to help evaluate who has the prospect of success. Have you thought about that? Maybe I'd start with you, Representative Brune, about that question.
I mean, I understand the role of the OECDD, and I don't have any problem with that. Once again, it's an experiment. I had a conversation with Jody earlier. Once again, I was trying to make this, the idea here is to, frankly, to make it as hassle-free as possible. As you well articulated, the Department of Revenue already does everything that we would ask them to do with this bill. Is there a marketing? What we're not asking the Department of Revenue to do, or something I'm not asking them to do, is to market this. And I think there's a value to marketing this, and the OECD is obviously the better entity to do some marketing with that. I'd have no problem, you know, having them sort of administer the plan. Obviously, it still has to be, you know, whether or not the tax lien issues and everything else have to come from Department of Revenue. So.
Could I answer that, too?
Please.
Thank you. I think that what's missing from this bill is any kind of expectation the department, there's no statement that they said they could disqualify somebody for being in bankruptcy, for already owing the state, you know, $20,000 in back taxes. There's nothing here that gives them the right to disqualify, and so that would have to be there. And I think that while they're used to looking at people's taxes, they're not used to qualifying a business for a bank loan, and that's some of what we'd be doing, and the OECD.
And in that case, you mean revenue, the revenue department.
Right, the revenue department isn't used to that role. But I think using the marker of how much taxes do you pay, you actually are profitable, I think it's brilliant. And I think that if the two departments could work together and the taxpayer who wants to use this loan signed a piece of paper that said they could share information back and forth so they really could, you know, verify that there are the right number of employees, because we've got W-2s for these people and that sort of thing, I think would be valuable. But there's one other thing that I forgot to mention. It was a concern. This bill would allow a company to not pay $200,000 in year one, $200,000 in year two. And in year three, they would have a balloon loan. That's the very kind of loan that's killing people right now, because they would owe their next year, let's assume no growth, $200,000 worth of taxes plus $100,000 worth of back taxes and some interest. And that would be a huge jump for them suddenly to get to. And business people are very hopeful sometimes about how their business is going to succeed. I have to just read those Saturday articles in the Oregonian where the new business talks about how we had $350 million worth of sales this year and we're going to have $63 million worth of sales 5 years from now. You know, well, that doesn't happen for a lot of them. And so we're almost inviting them into bad credit just as people have been invited into bad credit by the way we've been able to borrow on houses in the past. And that I'm cautious about doing that without them having a conversation with somebody that really reminds them that they have a responsibility here. And I do agree with the people who suggested that we would need them to put their own name on the line, not hide behind the corporation, or have some assets at risk. Otherwise, the state's the only one at risk.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your remark about the risk is the foundation of my question. And Representative Green, I think this goes to the heart of what you're trying to do with this bill, and so I'm just going to ask, is the idea that the risk would shift to the state, or is the idea that this is more of a loan program that we're trying to tide the business over? Because either it's a grant or it's a loan, and I hate to be caught somewhere in the middle. If it's a loan, then Jody's remark regarding the security is missing, and we need it. If it's a grant, then it's kind of okay as it is, because we basically have said, okay, we're going to shoulder the risk. But the bill is unclear as to which direction it intends
to go.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. Actually, I mean, I think the bill, at least from my reading of the bill, it's fairly clear to what it is. It is absolutely not a grant. That's not what we're trying to achieve here. We're trying to achieve a mechanism, an alternative to, as I talked about in the beginning, traditional bank financing. Okay, traditional bank financing being you go in and you ask for a loan and you sort through. This is an alternative to that for those businesses that historically and traditionally, and especially in the current credit market we're in, find it either very difficult, even if they're a successful business. Want to get back to that. I mean, yes, it is and should be difficult for an unsuccessful business to acquire traditional bank credit. But it, once again, in my experience, it's also very difficult for a successful small business to acquire traditional bank credit. So this program is very much designed to be a bridge, if you will, for those sorts of companies that find themselves in that situation. They're young, they're growing, they're successful by a profitability standard, yet they fall outside of the sweet spot, if you will, for commercial lending, and as a result of that have always found themselves in the sweet spot of the Visa cards. You talk to any small business owner that needs financing, and they'll tell you that how they finance is on their business Visa card,
right? And that does clear up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That does clear up the concept that you're trying to get at with this bill, which is a loan, and therefore, from my experience, we would need to tighten up the security. But in that regard, the lien against all real and personal property, I think, leaves out some types of property, and so we would have to broaden that to make sure it's all property of whatever type. So we get the accounts receivable and we get the other intangibles that are floating around that don't really fit one or the other. But that just is to tighten up the bill to make it more of a loan and less of the possibility of a grant.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask, what was the other agency? I said economic development, but was that the other agency you were talking about possibly being involved?
Yes, that's the one I was referring to, and I was just making a quip about the bill that we heard last time about its name potentially changing the business development.
Okay. Was that what you were referring to as well?
The OEDD. Is that the current acronym, Mr.
OECDD.
Chair? OECDD. Okay. It changes every time.
We don't use acronyms.
That's some other committee. I don't mind acronyms.
Okay, fine. Well, let's PDQ.
There's no one else signed up on the bill. Is there anyone who would like to be heard on House Bill 2715? Seeing none, and seeing no further questions, appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this. And I would love the committee's direction, and I realize it's not a work session sort of situation. What I'm planning to do is go to LC. We're changing the rate of interest, prime rate, not the primary discount rate. We're putting an 8-year sunset on it. I hear Representative Bentz, what you're calling for. I'm not sure it doesn't do that. I'd have to verify that with LC. But if it's not done in the current bill, I understand all assets. And a component that requires a personal guarantee, if that's the direction of the committee. I want to make sure that's sort of the sense of the committee. If
I think you've been taking good notes, Representative Brown.
And the final thing would be have it administered by the OECD.
Right. I think that's right.
Economic folks.
The other one that might make some sense also is to at least consider the possibility of a cap.
Oh, a dollar cap.
Right, or potentially a number of participants or some combination.
Yeah.
Representative Witt, I saw your hand first, and then come back to Representative
Benz. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Specific grounds on which to disqualify an applicant would be helpful for me.
Oh, so any prior, well, how about this, that you're not qualified, I mean, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, if you have any, if either the business itself or the principal of the business or principals of the business, the owners of record, have any tax liens, any unpaid taxes that they would not qualify for, does that sort of meet your one of your reservations?
Well, probably some kind of credit check would be.
Let's leave it at this for the moment. That you guys can talk about the very particulars,
but I
think that general concept,
the
of
concept,
making
right,
sure that
right.
Tax compliance is an element of,
right,
of qualifications. Does that cover it for you, Representative?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is one major thing that's not in that list, and that is whether or not they have assets sufficient to secure the loan, because that's not here. And
it's not, and I'm now we're getting to be a bank, and that's, Mr. Chair, just for conversation, that's not what I'm trying to do here. I think it eliminates the opportunity for it to work.
Mr. Chair, follow up,
please.
But now we're right to the nub of the issue, and that is: is it a grant or is it a loan?
No, it's a loan, but we're not a bank.
But we're unsecured.
Yeah,
it's an unsecured loan.
It would be well. I have no problem taking a. A tax lien is a security interest as long as there's assets to be leaned against. Even, and maybe you know this, Representative Benz, better than I do, but even in a situation of bankruptcy, failure, or dissolution, this tax lien still applies to the given assets. I don't think the assets are free, and I don't think the assets are free and clear from a tax lien. They're not. They wouldn't be. They may be from another sort of debt instrument, but from a tax lien, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that there's bankruptcy isn't enough to
follow.
And that's my ignorance on the issue. I don't know the exact answer to that.
I do, oddly enough, but the
it's not odd at all. We appreciate your presence here for that, among many other reasons.
No, it happens that the tax lien is inferior to all those who have perfected before it. It is not dischargeable bankruptcy.
Hmm.
Most of the time, there are certain types of bankruptcy, like a Chapter 13, where you can get rid of them. But most of the time, a C corp can't qualify for a 13. But all that aside, the issue is one of whether or not, at the time we make this decision, we are going to force the borrower to prove they have assets sufficient to secure it. Because if you don't, then we're an unsecured loan. Because we don't know that
right,
there's anything
right,
there that isn't already
right,
leaned up to the hill.
Yeah. Hey, Mr. Chair, just like a Visa card is, frankly, but the difference between what we're talking here, and I appreciate Representative Holby's comment and suggestion, is that what you don't have with a Visa card is a personal guarantee. It's a personal debt. It's not a personal guarantee. And this would, regardless of the status of the given C corporation, whether it's alive, dead, or somewhere in between, the principal who signed the guarantee would carry that obligation with him or her wherever they go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is true. And if the folks signing the guarantee have assets and show that at the time, then at least you would have the hope that they would still have them in 2 years.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, once again, I think we can turn this into the Small Business Administration Loan Program, and that's not what I'm trying to do. And I don't disregard or ignore a single comment. I mean, it's good. I mean, I want to make sure, though, that the intent of the bill stays whole, which is this is outside of the box. This is something new in an unprecedented economic situation. Okay. If we turn this into a bank loan by any other name, it just happens to be. I mean, I frankly don't want the government in the business of being a bank. I want the banks to be the banks. Certainly, I want the state of Oregon to do. This is taking some attributes that the state of Oregon has that banks don't necessarily have. It's designed to
to create jobs and a long-term tax, healthy taxpayer, rather than the bank's primary motivation, which is a short-time profit center. And so, I mean, we could talk about that all day long. But if we make it exactly a bank loan, then it is just that, exactly a bank loan, and I don't think it's necessary.
So, recognizing that, and if I believe I've heard you correctly, this is an experiment. Representative Benz, would it help your concern, and I appreciate the way you're raising it, if the cap, whether it's in terms of dollars or participants, is small enough that the risk, though it's present, is relatively small, to see whether there are other criteria that can emerge to help OECDD and the Department of Revenue as they begin this, manage that in an appropriate way?
Thank you, Chair. It strikes me that we have to make a decision of whether we want to make this either a loan or a grant. That, and once we decide which it is, everything else will fall directly into place.
Okay.
We can move down the size of the grant, as you just suggested, but without adequate security, we are taking the risk, and thus we have to look through that risk and say, this is where we're going to be.
Okay.
So,
Representative Foley.
Thank you. I really appreciate Representative Bent's line of questioning and, you know, listening, and I appreciate the concept. And it becomes clear to me that this program is sometimes a grant and sometimes a loan, depending on whether or not the people who get the money pay it back.
There you have it. Nicely done. Well, that might be a good way to conclude at least this portion of the conversation. And it sounds like we may have some more to talk about offline, but again, appreciate you both
thank
being
you, Mr.
here.
Chair. Thank you, committee, very much.
Thank you
for your long indulgence. That was great.
It was a good conversation. And with apologies to the folks who just came into the room, we had a fairly short agenda today, at least in terms of items. And I think we've, in the words of our revenue committee chair, exhausted that agenda. This side of the room has been very quiet. Unless you have any comments for the good of the order, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2715 and adjourn the committee. Thank you.
It's the first time I've had the last word in this committee.